Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your work day or your work days here to begin the show. Do you dread going to work on some days or maybe most days? Have you thought about why that is? Wonder what you can do to embrace your job and feel less stressed? Try to answer those questions in this first hour of the show today as we visit with Guy Winch back with us. Guy's a psychologist, author, co-host of the Dear Therapists podcast, and his latest book is what we're going to be talking about, an interesting one. It's titled Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. And I hope you'll join in as we talk with Guy. Tell us what's bothered you at your workplace, maybe how you dealt with it, or maybe you have a question about how to deal with it. Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Guy Winch, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
At the beginning of your book, Mind Over Grind, you argue that more Americans than ever are feeling a high degree of stress at work. Is this a problem for people with specific professions, or are most jobs unreasonably stressful?
I think these days, what the numbers show is that stress and burnout are peaking in the workplace in general. And I think it goes across, most professions. I mean, I remember the one job I had in life in which I did not stress about my job the second the job was over was when I was waiting tables. I never went home and kind of spent the evening worrying about, oh, I wish I could have served them more quickly or something like that. You know what I mean? There's some jobs that you're done, but most of them are stressful, are difficult, are tense. You know, there are all these things happening now to create uncertainty in the marketplace in so many sectors. So I think it's the majority.
Yeah. Is there a time when stress is beneficial?
When stress is short and acute, then it's beneficial. It's a useful response to have. It warns us when something is coming at us, when there's some kind of danger. If it's a quick thing, then it's fine. The problem with stress today is that it becomes chronic. People can be activated and kind of in fight or flight at work every day because their office politics and people are trying to, you know, step on their turf and they're feuding with this, or they have a difficult boss, or there's harassment going on, or there's just a lot of tension, there are cuts looming, all these things that make people tense and stressed out throughout much, if not most, of the workday, and then it becomes really chronic. We're not really well designed to experience that all day, day after day after day.
Yeah, and then that could result in burnout, I guess. Well, how would you define burnout, by the way?
Burnout is defined by several things. It's, you know, its main feature is this sense of just deep exhaustion, not the kind that a good night's sleep will do away with. You just feel, and I was burnt out earlier in my career. I know this firsthand. You really feel like you're going through the motions. You feel dread at everything. You're disconnected from things. You lose the meaning. You lose the joy. You lose the excitement about what you're doing. You're just trying to get through. There's a real cynicism about your work that comes through. You really lose touch with why it was important, if it ever was, and all those things. And so it really does a very general number. It just turns you into a drone. You're just trying to get through it, but it just with no emotion or satisfaction or meaning behind it.
And obviously that has a toll on your health.
It has a major toll on your health. It has a major toll on your health because when you're really stressed out, it affects your immune system functioning. It predisposes you to all kinds of illnesses, as does burnout. There's a real medical consequence. The World Health Organization estimates that 750,000 people die every year from overworking. You know, and again, they are burnt out, but they're not realizing it. It just can really compromise our health, our functioning, and especially, and this is a lot of what the book is about, our life outside of work. You know, the fact that if you're burnt out at your office, at your work during the day, you're not getting home happy-go-lucky. You're getting home and you're bringing that kind of dullness and that, you know, strain with you. So it really is going to impact your family life and your personal life outside of work.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe it's a good point to talk about your book. I liked how you sort of organized it by kind of like by days of the week. Well, talk about how you have this organized.
Well, I talk about different topics, and I do organize it by day of the week because each day of the week has its different challenges. You know, Sunday, the challenges, we get the Sunday blues, the Monday scaries, and we start feeling this feeling of dread as the work week approaches. And Monday is usually considered the most stressful and difficult day of the year. It's the day in which cardiovascular events are highest because that, you know, it's like jumping into a cold pool from the relative relaxation of the weekend. Now you go right into it. So that's a difficult day. As the week goes on, day after day, there are different kinds of challenges. And Friday, you have this mix of relief on the one hand because the weekend's coming, but exhaustion on the other. So I just thought it was a good way to organize the book. And I talk about the different challenges on every day and through that lens, the different challenges we all face in the workplace.
Yeah. And the folks you talk about, clients that you probably gave a different name to.
Of course, yes.
But you had me kind of rooting for them through the whole thing. It was a really nice way to use those examples, I think.
Yes, I decided that instead of just, you know, dipping into an example here or there, to follow five people throughout the entire book. We find out what happens to them, you know, and their stories, you know, last throughout the entire book. And then to really bring through their eyes what these issues are, but also what the interventions are, what the tools and techniques are. It's not just here's a problem, here's a tool. It's like here's how that affected them. Here's what the tool is. Here's how they used it. Here are the questions they had about it. I just felt it would be a much more interesting and illustrative way to bring the information to people.
I think you're absolutely right. It was certainly it held my interest and kept my interest going. As I've said, I was rooting for all of them.
Unfortunately, Larry, you always say to me, oh, I really like these characters. When they start the book, I like them. I hope nothing bad happens to them. And yeah. I'm like, well, if nothing bad happened, there really wouldn't be a book here. I mean, obviously, stuff happens. You know?
Yeah, stuff happens for sure. Well, you do argue that our work lives have kind of been hijacked by hijacked our personal lives. And how are employers responding to the decline in workers' mental health? Because we do see that, as you point out.
First of all, I want to point out that, you know, I make a little bit less of a distinction between employer and employee because I work with many employers and they suffer all the same ills of burnout and stress as their employees do. They're not sitting on the beach, you know, sipping Mai Tais, and they're like working really, really hard themselves. And so this should be, you know, this is addressed to them as well. And the problem with that employers have is they're trying to resolve stress and burnout by having programs and resources in the workplace. And it's not working because those stresses are no longer contained to the workplace. We bring them home with us. They affect our thoughts in the evenings. They affect our relationships. They affect our partners and our families, they affect our leisure time, they affect our sense of identity and how we conduct ourselves after work. And employers don't have control of us there. That's in our heads. And so part of my approach with this book is that, you know, yes, regardless of what the stresses are within the workplace, the best you can do is learn how to better manage them there and how to contain them so that they're not spreading and infecting your life outside of work, because they are in all these unconscious ways that most people are unaware of.
Talking today with Guy Winch about his book titled Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. Has work hijacked your life? Maybe a bit. Questions about it, give a call. The number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. So it's probably not enough, or how you talk about stressful workplaces, maybe they offer mental health resources to its employees. That enough?
I mean, it's great, But A, many employers do not avail themselves of them, and it's not sufficient because, again, what my research found when writing this book is that there's so many ways in which we bring those pressures home with us. Some of those, you know, some of that we're aware of, many of that we're not. And even if we are aware, we don't know how to stop that leakage from really leaking over from work. And by the way, it's not a leak, it's a gush. It gushes over from work into our personal lives, and it really creates an extension of that stress into the evening, into the weekend, and we mismanage it. We're not aware of that we're doing things that are really problematic.
Yeah.
And we don't even know how to recover correctly from the workday, which is, you know, there's a science about that. And so, like, there's so much in this, in so many ways, and we need to become more sophisticated about how we manage ourselves in this culture of a workplace that's highly stressful.
Yeah. Just this past weekend, I was listening to a program. It was an interview, and it was sports related, and it was three NBA players talking about stress in their job and how the NBA had said, "Well, they got together a group and of folks that would deal and talk with and advise and consult with the players," and they said, "Well, they'll never be, you know, we won't know about this and so forth, you know, who's coming." And then one of the guys said, "Did you ever go to one of those?" "Nope." And none of our players would. And they all three said none of them went, and none of their players went, because they figured it's going to get back to management that I'm having some kind of a mental issue, and then I am going to maybe lose my job.
Look, a lot of employees have that concern, right? In other words, that yes, if I avail myself of those resources, HIPAA laws notwithstanding, what if, you know, it, you know, what if that comes back to the management and they'll think, well, I can't handle the stress if I am going to seek help for it. And then you have entire professions that you really can't do that, because that will cost you, you know, pilots, etc. Like, oh, if you're going to get mental health, you know, assistance, then that could really, you know, then it's just not, it's not sanctioned well. And so, like, it is very difficult for people. But regardless of that, you know, like, I think a lot of the damages does happen outside of work, and it happens in, and that's what people need to be alerted to. Even within the workday, we don't take, you know, we're not smart about how we curate the breaks that we take, about how we, you know, manage ourselves during the pressures of a given workday. If you have a critically difficult meeting or a conflictual one, you know, you don't necessarily think to set up 5 minutes to get some emotional support from a colleague, or to do something to kind of, you know, like, get that, you know, get your mindset back to normal after you know you're going to have a very challenging meeting. We don't think to be more proactive and intentional in those ways.
Yeah. Lisa in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Lisa, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Larry. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, you're coming in loud and clear.
Great. Thank you. I'm calling actually on behalf of my 30-year-old son. He and I are very close. He's dealing with, I think, major PTSD. He works for a wonderful company out of Kaukauna called Midwest. You don't need to know the name. It's a restoration company, and he's been there a couple of years. So he's responding to homicides and suicides, and they kind of debrief in that they let the guys, the people, take a day, half a day off if something has really troubled them. But he's also dealing with a lot of chemicals, mold, and who knows what else. They're doing fire restoration and water damage stuff. And he I think, is like his dad and I, where we kind of sort of are putting out this imposter syndrome. We act like everything's totally cool and it's not bothering us on the surface. And then we get alone and we freak out. So my boy's been calling me with panic attacks every time he's on call. And he is getting some behavioral health help now, but these were like paralyzing him. And he would call crying and telling me, "Mom, I can't do it anymore. I have to quit. And I would tell him, "Honey, you know, your job doesn't define you. You go ahead and quit if that's what you need to do. But can I help you get a backup plan? You know, I'll help you go to job service or whatever's out there now." And he's got a great benefit package and just became engaged. So he doesn't want to do that right now, but he's losing it. he's losing it at times, and I think he's got the upper hand. He's relying on his spirituality and reaching out to friends. But other than that, I, as a mother, I don't know what to tell him, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Guy, these are the kinds of things you might deal with over a couple of years' time with a person, but Lisa certainly has, Lisa's son certainly has a tough situation.
He does, but, you know, Lisa, I just want to tell you, you've done everything right over there. What you've said to him is, like, it's okay if this job is not for you, if it's too difficult. I will help you find and think of alternatives. I'm there for you. There's nothing wrong in kind of prioritizing these things. So I think you've said all the right things to him. I'm glad he's getting help now, but it takes a while. The one, you know, quote-unquote good thing about panic attacks, it's a very noticeable symptom. Either those get better or not. In other words, with the help that he's getting, either he can manage and find a way to keep doing his job without getting those kinds of panic attacks. And if he cannot, then he really does need to think very seriously about switching, because I'm glad he's getting engaged, he's getting married, it's good benefits. He's not going to be happy in the marriage or anywhere if he keeps having to deal with these panic attacks. So I'm glad that he's getting the help. But once you have breakthrough symptoms like that, it's a good idea to keep your eye on them and see, now, is this helping? Is it going away? Sometimes it's just not a good match. You know, like that job is just too difficult. It brings up too many traumatic or triggering situations that somebody cannot manage.
Yeah, Lisa, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Guy Winch, our guest today, as we talk with him about his book, Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the workplace, and Guy Winch, our guest, as we talk with him about his book, Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You know, you've mentioned this more than once, this whole business of stress at work, it takes itself home.
It very much does. Here are a couple of the findings of the research that really surprised me when I learned about them on the one hand, and yet kind of confirmed what I was seeing in my work with individuals on the other. Number one, there's research that shows that when one person is very stressed and pressured at work, their partner can start to develop symptoms of burnout. Their partner, who's not in that situation, because it's that's how much it spills over and carries over to the home. And another one, which was equally surprising yet not, is that when one person is very, very stressed out at work, their partner can lose their sex drive as a result. And again, surprising in that it transfers that significantly. Not surprising, because when someone comes home stressed and preoccupied and tense, not a turn on for most people. So yes, you might lose your sex drive. It's hard to feel, you know, romantic when the person next to you is in such a, you know, stressed out state. So that's not surprising, but it's just examples of how these things really spill over into the home and how much we bring them home with us. And one last finding is that when we get really, really stressed out at work, it's not just that those stresses will transfer to our partner, we will unconsciously start to undermine them within the home without realizing we're doing it, because we're so checked out, we're so in a different place, we're not noticing that our responses and our behavior are actually problematic and undermining to our partner, because we're that much not present in the home, checked out and somewhere else.
Reggie in Oshkosh, we'll go to you next. Hi, Reggie. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how's it going? I'm on the road in case it cuts out, so I apologize ahead of time.
All right, what's on your mind?
So I haul fuel in Wisconsin, so I'm in my semi a good chunk of the day. I work in all different types of weather. It's very loud in the semi, and, you know, I've got, you know, 7,000-8,000 gallons of fuel behind me all day, or the vapor from it, which is even more dangerous. I get home, and I'm literally vibrating for like a half hour. Just from the noise and the stress, and is there a good way to just, like, calm down? Because I work long days, and the kids and everyone's like, oh, hey, you're home, blah, 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 and I just need to, like, decompress.
Yeah. Well, you certainly talk about this in your book, Guy.
I absolutely do. I mean, first of all, you need to alert your family that I get home, but then when I get home, I need a little bit of time to shift my mindset and to decompress, because you absolutely do. I mean, I think it's a great description. I'm vibrating still from the noise, from the tension, from all of these, you know, the concentration and all of it. So first of all, alert them. The fact that Daddy walks through the door does not mean Daddy is available, you know, for Daddy duties right now. And then find a quiet place. And what I recommend is to develop a transition ritual that helps you shift your mindset from your workday to your home life. And that should include the following ingredients. First of all, music. You know, find a playlist, find songs that help you kind of calm down, shift your mindset, remind you of home, remind you of what it's like to be away from work. Listen to that music. Change your clothes when you get home. Shower, that's sometimes also useful to do because it's quite immersive. But change your clothes, which you probably do, but make sure to do that, into clothes that you associate with being relaxed, with being home. It's very, very noisy where you work. So having some quiet time, maybe get some earplugs or stuff like that, because a house of kids can be noisy as well. But to kind of help your mind learn to kind of, you know, down gear from the gear you're at literally when you're working to a, you know, to the first gear, second gear at most. So use those things. Use the time to kind of quiet your mind. Use a shower to change the clothes. Use music to do it. Use earplugs to do it, to have some quiet if you need to. And do some breathing exercise like box breathing. Box breathing is when you breathe in to the count of four, hold your breath to the count of four, breathe out to the count of four, hold your breath to the count of four, and repeat. It's like a box of four, 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 four. And that will help you regulate your breathing. But you absolutely need a little bit of time to shift your mindset and to calm down so you can be present at home. It's not reasonable to expect you'll be able to like snap your fingers and shift from one mode to another. But ask your family to give you that grace and to give you that time to be a shift. And tell them, if I have that time, I'll be much, much more present and much more enjoyable to be around once I emerge from whatever that solitude place is.
Yeah, and just have that conversation. You need to have that communication, that conversation.
Yes.
Yeah. Reggie, and good luck. I appreciate your call very much. And you've described something that unfortunately is a situation that many folks experience. And so I really appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Sue had emailed to say she retired at age 64 as she was concerned about the health impact of her crazy hours as a salaried employee. A single woman with grandchildren, a home to maintain, and wasn't willing to give up her social life and health. But she retired at 64, now approaching 77, very healthy, and no regrets about her current lower income.
Good. You know what? I the chapter before last in the book is a chapter about whether to stay or whether to go and what considerations you need to have, like how to know when it is time to leave. And there are a lot of considerations also in terms of where you are in your career, whether you're towards the end, what retirement might look like for you. And absolutely, taking a cut in terms of money, in terms of compensation, limiting, you know, what you might be able to do in that way, and substituting that for a higher quality of life, for less stress, for more health, is a very, very fine consideration indeed. And here's an example of someone who did that math and said, you know what, I will be happier even if I, you know, have less money to live on and I have to cut down in some of the things that I do. I will be happier taking that, you know, cut. And that's true with retirement, and sometimes it's true of switching to another job where the quality of life will be higher.
Yeah, there she is 13 years later, and doesn't regret her decision.
Yeah, great to hear.
One bit. I wanted to bring up emails and as a part of this being at home. I'll tell you one little story. As a professor here at the University of Wisconsin, and you typically have 100 undergraduate advisees to work with, and they all have my phone number, or they know how to get me via email. And I once got I got a call from our department chair, and she said, "Gee, there's a wondering what's going on. I got an email from a student who said he hadn't been able to get a hold of you via email," and I didn't understand it. And so I went and I had gone from work to a meeting. And had been at a meeting, and apparently while I was at the meeting, he sent an email to me at about 5:30 or 6, somewhere in there, and he emailed my department chair at 9 o'clock, 3 hours later, and said, "What's going on? I can't get a hold of Larry." And I was really miffed about that at first. In fact, for a bit, and I had to really think about it, and I had, this kid must be under a lot of stress. I explained to her, right, and she was quite, she knew there was my boss, let's say, the department chair, knew that I'm normally pretty good about emails, but you are, and you report in the book that there's research. I think it's like 70% of professionals or people with a college education have to answer their emails like 24/7.
First of all, your interpretation is very charitable, I would like to say. You know, Larry, like, oh, the poor young man might have been quite distressed. I would have gone with quite entitled. But anyway, let that aside.
Well, first, yeah. I was mad. And then I thought about it.
Fair enough. But look, it's true. And on average, some people, you know, in jobs can do like 8 hours of emails after hours a week. That's an extra day of work. And as a lot of people tell me, the problem is that it's not that I'd have to answer that many. Sometimes I only have to answer two or three emails, except I have to read through 200 of them to figure out which two or three those are. So I'm spending the entire evening checking my phone, checking my phone, checking my phone. Here's the problem with that. It keeps you at work. When you are thinking about work when you're home, you are at work mentally, and you're not at home, for sure. You know, that's when you're checked out. And so there needs to be a way that you can respond to emails, because most employers expect you to do so at some point, but do it in a way that doesn't ruin your time at home. If you're checking your phone every few minutes for emails, you cannot be present in what you're doing at home, and you're going to be in fight or flight, and you're going to be activated and stressed, and that's really bad. That's when the chronic stress can come in and the burnout can come in. The technique I suggest in the book is called red light, green light, and in essence, it's to choose a time in the evening that's convenient for you, that's least disruptive to your plans. Let's say it's 6, 7 o'clock, it's 8 o'clock, whatever the time is, 9 o'clock, depending on your hours. And that during that time, for 15, 20 minutes, half an hour if you need, 5 if it's only 5, that's when you will check and respond to emails. You will not do so before, and you will not do so after. And the way that works is that you want to trick your brain into feeling like you are in control of your time when you're not at work, rather than work is in control of your time at home, because that makes a big difference. And so if you do it that way, you kind of define the evening as the main event, the show. Now, by the way, the show is not fancy. It can be I'm having dinner with my family, then I'm putting the kids to bed, and then I'm watching TV for a bit. We're not talking fancy. But in that constellation, let's say that's the plan, that's my plan for the evening. That's what I want to be present doing. There, between the time of putting the kids to bed and watching a show, or somewhere there, what I decide and let people know ahead of time, I will take an intermission from the show. And that's when I will check and respond to emails. And when you define it that way in your brain, as my main show is my life after hours, I will take an intermission from life to respond to emails, then your brain still feels like you're in control. You have the autonomy to decide how your time goes. And that turns out is really, really helpful for keeping you in a calm state rather than keeping you activated.
Yeah, I really like that approach. That red light, green light is, I think, a great idea when it comes to that situation. Jay in Two Rivers has something for us. Jay, hi.
Good morning and happy election day, gentlemen.
To you as well.
Interesting, the last job that I had before retiring was by far the most toxic job that I ever had in over 50 years of employment. But the upside is I've been happily retired for 12 years, a little earlier than I had expected. And I'm just wondering how often it is that from the top of the executive, the top executives, all of the management, and even the lower supervisors, there's almost nothing I have good to say. And I kept track, and they went through at minimum 125% turnover every year. They had a weekly list on the entrance door of people we should report if we see them that they weren't allowed on the premises. It was just really eye-opening. There's lots of stories, but I'll end it at that.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, you know, that's about workplace culture, right? I mean, in other words, you're describing, you know, you use the word, it's a toxic culture. And the problem with toxic cultures is that they do filter down from the top. And they force everyone to, you know, play by those rules. It's very difficult to insulate yourself from that. If it's such a difficult, challenging, unfriendly, uncaring workplace that they're churning through turnover in that level, and you're saying, like, 50 years of working, I had a lot of comparisons, this one was really out there. And there definitely are companies like that. And what's remarkable to me is that, you know, yes, it does come from the top. And what's remarkable to me is that the people at the top don't seem to realize that they are harming themselves, they are shooting themselves in the foot. Because the turnover is going to cost you a lot of money to rehire, to retrain people is very, very expensive, number one. They're not going to be that productive. You are forcing them to spend so much of their mental energy managing stress, managing hostility, managing toxicity, they're going to have just less left over with which to actually do their jobs. The irony of all of this is that it actually benefits both employer and employee to have kinder, more caring workplaces, because you get much more out of your people, quote unquote, when they actually care, when they're engaged, when they're not operating by fear. So it's just so, so unfortunate. But that's a great example. Even the example you gave about their lists for, like, report them if they're on the premises. I mean, it feels like, you know, release the hounds. Why don't you? I mean, it's that kind of place. I'm glad you left.
How risky is it for employees to challenge situations like that, or maybe not that extreme, but just challenging uncaring bosses or complain about being overworked?
That too depends on culture, because there's some workplaces in which you might have a boss that's difficult, an incident that happened. I mean, those things can happen. And in some cultures, in some workplace cultures, it's okay to challenge them, to go to HR, etc. And yet in others, that will be a very dangerous thing to do. They might have to go through the motions, but HR is always caught, because they always, you know, they are supposed to represent you, but they also have to protect the company they work for. So they're always in a bind. You know, like they have certain edicts that they have to do, but there are always pressures on them as well. And if they're too lenient or too pro you, then they won't last long in their jobs either. So you really have to read the room in terms of what the culture is. Is that something that's accepted here or not? If you're going to try and do something about it, getting a couple of other people to back you up, and you know, if there's two or three people it happened to as opposed to one, you're always in a much stronger position. But be very, very thoughtful and careful. Make sure you document and really look around and make sure that that is something that can actually work, because in many companies, you know, people will say fine, but the next time there are cuts coming around, you'll be on the list.
And just to go along with that, we have an email. Do you do corporate culture counseling as well as counsel individual employees, is the question?
Yeah, well, I work with certain companies. I advise a couple of startups, and I sometimes work with top leadership in certain companies. I've even advised, you know, the UK government about some things. But yes, but here's the thing. I mean, that sounds terrific, except the people who come for me for that kind of work are people who are open to it in the first place.
Yeah.
They usually, you know, on the better side of things to begin with. Otherwise, they wouldn't. Do you know what I mean? And so it helps. So I always say, you know, people are always open to that when they come to me, but that's why they come to me, because they are.
A listener emailed to say that a great way to de-stress and quiet the mind is through meditation. The listener worked for 45 years in a high-stress job, and meditation has done wonders for them for transitioning from work to home life.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think meditation is wonderful for that. It helps quiet the mind, and it has many, many usages. One is, yes, to help transition from work to home. If you meditate for a while, and especially if you experience that, so you can actually do it quite effectively. But the other time it's very useful to do is at work. You can meditate in certain breaks. You can take 5 minutes between difficult meetings and kind of meditate, regulate your emotions, kind of restabilize yourself. So meditation is an extremely useful tool. I'm very much for it. I suggest it if people aren't familiar with it. There are many resources online for free that you can get to practice it. It's not that difficult, but it's one of those highly effective tools that you should have in your arsenal.
I was thinking about that one other item you mentioned that I agreed with immediately because I do it myself, and that is a bit of exercise. And it doesn't have to be fancy exercise. And I do a couple mile, 3 mile maybe walk daily.
Yeah. And so that's good when you can do the 3 miles. And sometimes people, even during the workday, if you've been sitting down all day, go up and down some stairs if you have a couple of minutes. Do like a minute of push-ups, just like, you know, get your muscles going, get your mind actually focused on your body rather than on the troubles of the day. So exercise is very, very useful. The best use of it, by the way, is exercise in nature. Because yes. Then you have the double combo of nature and exercise. I unfortunately live in Manhattan. The exercise and nature options are severely limited. but for you guys, I think you have way more options than I. I know the weather can be a limiting factor. But nonetheless, exercise and nature are a great combo.
Our guest, Guy Winch, his book, Mind Over Grind, and the subtitle, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. Had some good calls today. If you have a question, comments, or maybe an experience, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk about how a UW-Madison facility at the South Pole is helping solve some of the biggest mysteries of the universe. That's at noon today. Right now, talking with author Guy Winch about his book, Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. Sarah emailed to say she's paid hourly and works from home. She's expected to respond to emails at all times, but is only paid for her time when executing tasks. With this setup, Sarah's in constant work mode. She has tried walking away from the computer and not being as attentive, but she often finds herself coming back to a flood of work or feeling the pull to check on things. And wondering about advice.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I feel like, are you allowed to go and see, I don't know if you have kids, but go and see their recital? Are you allowed to get a massage? Are you allowed to go swimming? Are you allowed to have a romantic moment? In other words, all of those things are going to happen away from the computer and take you away, and it might take an hour for you to respond. And so it's also, if you are responding, you know, so quickly that you have to be there for every 10 or 15 minutes, then either, you know, then you're also training your employer that, you know, I will be able to do that. But if it takes an hour and somebody says, well, why didn't you respond sooner? I think it's fair to say, I was unavailable. I was busy. Well, what were you doing? That's inappropriate. You know, because again, whether you're having a romantic moment, having a bath, you went swimming, you know, like you're allowed to have a life. And so if it's outside of work hours, you really need to start pushing against the envelope there and like taking more and more time and training yourself to be able to step away from the laptop without feeling anxiety.
Yeah. Jim in Madison has a question for us. Jim, hello.
Hey, hello, Larry. This is a great subject you have today. My question concerns a coworker that got promoted to being the boss. and he's a little insecure, so he's a narcissist. He really puts you down during meetings and things. I think it's mainly because of the insecurity, he's in charge now. He kind of took over for the owner who passed away suddenly. And I was wondering how you handle a coworker / boss like that.
Hmm. I mean, I don't know if you're still on the line. What are they doing that's difficult for you, other than just looking down and feeling insecure and trying to cover for it? What are they doing that's making life more difficult for you?
Since they're the boss, they'll kind of call you out at meetings and stuff, even though it's not your fault, it's their fault. You know, they'll kind of drop the ball for certain customers, and they'll kind of throw it in your lap. Like, why wasn't this done or that? Or, you know, talk to the customer and move things out, and just kind of incompetent. They don't do the job very well. And then I was kind of at the end of the line with the project. So I was ultimately responsible for the success of the project, and I'm kind of covering for them. And so it's a multitude of things that happen.
Yeah. And you actually deal with that in your book. You have a fairly specific example of that in your book.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely there's definitely someone there who deals with these kinds of political situations, but here's the thing. First of all, the things you want to do are really document, because in other words, if you have documentation of like, no, I definitely emailed you about that. Here's the email you might have forgotten. Like, it's about setting boundaries with them when you have the documentation to back it up. Doing it politely, doing it respectfully. You don't want to shame them, because that's not gonna help you necessarily, but you might want to approach them after the meeting and say, hey, you called me out on that, but here's the email. I'm just reminding you, this was something that was, on your plate, not on mine. You need to find ways when you can, show it in black and white to kind of set limits in that way and let them know, like, you can't really say that when that's not true. I will respond to it. It is a tricky situation in general, though, when somebody gets moved up and they're not competent and they're not sufficiently able to do their job, and they're just trying to cover and then blame and project and do those things. It's a difficult transition for all. But to protect yourself, you want to be able to document things, keep things, and again, respond in a way that doesn't shame them publicly, because they are the boss now, but that you can go to them afterwards. And if you do that, they will learn that, let me not put him on the spot again, because he'll then come to me and stand up for himself in ways that he can, because he has it all documented.
Hmm. Interesting. Jim, good luck, and thank you very much for your call. Kevin in Princeton couldn't stay with us. He went to a conference and learned about the turnover of health and childcare workers, and just wonders, what do people in these particular professions face stress-wise that leads to burnout?
Well, compassion fatigue is a lot of what they face, because they, in the health professions, in the mental health professions, in childcare, you deal with a lot of distressed clients. You deal with a lot of people who are going through objectively very heartbreaking, difficult, challenging situations, and you are there to support them, to be with them. So you have to contain that. You have to have empathy for it. And when you're constantly empathizing with people who are really in truly challenging, painful, difficult situations, there's a fatigue that sets in that you don't have that much more compassion to give. You're like running out of it in some way. It's called compassion fatigue. And so it's an additional stressor that people experience. We're social animals, and when somebody, and we're working with them, tells us about a very stressful, unfortunate situations, we feel a measure of that ourselves for them in that empathy, and that can really wear us down over time if we don't know how to manage it effectively.
I was thinking about that in terms that thought just went out of my mind. I'll admit to that. Let me turn to something else. The one point I was going to make, now I remember, it related to childcare workers.
Mm-hmm.
Along with everything else, their pay scales are among the lowest. I mean, they're just not good. They're not they're not being paid for what they have to do.
Right, and that includes teachers a lot of the time, and that includes a lot of kinds of, you know, nurses in many capacities, etc. And these are the kinds of jobs where you are on all the time. You're not sitting in an office where you can take 20 minutes now to start taking care of personal business or to doodle. You know, like this, you know, there's the noise, chaos, this stuff going on all around you. So it's a very, very demanding job. You have to prepare. Teachers never have enough equipment and resources and time. It's extremely challenging.
There are so many things that we're not going to get to even a tenth of all that you talk about in your book, which is so many good pieces of information on how to deal with things. One I liked was the memoir test.
That's about frustrations, and that when you're in a bad mood because something upsetting, frustrating, a setback happened, and people are like, I don't know how to get out of that bad mood. And a lot of the times, you know, and so the memoir test is like, basically ask yourself this: if you at some point in your life write your memoirs about this was my life, is this incident going to make it in? Probably not. Probably not. It was a minor irritation. It seemed really annoying in the moment, but in the grand perspective of your life, it just wasn't significant enough to make it into the memoir. So that memoir test is a good way to get perspective, to kind of zoom out and go like, yeah, it's annoying me right now, but it's like a stubbing of the toe. Like, okay, it's not going to matter tomorrow. It's not going to matter in a week, or it's not going to matter in a year. Therefore, I should really endeavor to let it go.
Yeah. And just reducing the intensity. I mean, you had three. There were three points you made that I thought were good ones. One was shifting your perspective, which is what the memoir kind of does.
Yeah, it shifts your perspective. It kind of reframes the incident as not as significant as it might feel to you in that moment. And by thinking about the memoir part, you're also doing a mental time travel where you're zooming out and seeing the incident from 10, 20, 30 years time. And when we time travel that way, when we zoom out psychologically, we also distance ourselves emotionally. And so that's a brain hack for lessening the emotional impact that you feel in a moment, because you're like gaining that psychological distance, which gives you more emotional distance.
So you're shifting your perspective, and you're finding, and then I like finding a silver lining too.
And you always can, because there's, you know, anything that happens is informative in some way. And if it's not, then it also teaches you like, okay, now I need to figure out how to handle this kind of situation. Or, you know, like the gentleman with the colleague turned boss who's difficult. It's like, yeah, there are obnoxious bosses. They're narcissistic bosses. Like, here's your opportunity to learn how to manage them, how to handle them, how to deal with them in ways that are productive for you, or like mitigate somewhat the annoyance, the aggravation that you would feel. So there's some utility in the practice.
Yeah. And just I want to go to vacations because it's important to take vacations, you say.
Yeah. And the book ends with a chapter about the science of restorative vacations. We all take vacations. They're not always restorative. And it's full of tips for how to make your vacation more useful. I'll mention one that I learned early in practice. And boy, does it make a difference. Do not get to your vacation exhausted. Do not work until 1 a.m. the night before to get ahead. Because then it'll take you 3 or 4 days to relax and enjoy your vacation, by which point half the vacation is over, if not all. And so I actually try and rest up the couple of evenings before I go on vacation. I try to start, you know, lowering the gear, you know, and kind of being more relaxed in a more vacation ready mindset. And when I do that, it's remarkable. I get to that first day of vacation and I'm able to relax right away, as opposed to like, it takes me 2 or 3 days to stop, days to stop thinking about work and gearing down.
Well, I wish we had more time to go through the rest of this, because there are so many helpful tips, and you've given many of them today, but there are many, many more in your book. Thank you so much, Guy, for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you, great listeners.
Guy Winch is our author today, and his book, and he's written other books too, Mind Over Grind is the title of this one. Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Ice Cube Project. How about that? I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.